I would now like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Al B. from Thousand Oaks.
Hi, everybody. I'm Al B., and I'm an alcoholic. And, the first thing I want to do, I want to welcome everybody that's a newcomer. I hate the word newcomer. Everybody that's new. Yeah, I want to welcome you, and I want to challenge you also. I hope that you'll stick around long enough for this thing to work in your life. There's a real miracle that happens in here, and it has to do with the steps and the traditions. And I hope you don't quit 5 minutes before that miracle happens to you, because it will happen to you. If it can happen to me, it can happen to anybody. I want to thank Liz, my good friend, for coming down here with me. She had to listen to this all the way down. So she is personally responsible if I bomb. Because I take direction. And Terry, wherever he is, said he was in the back row. I knew it, back row, of course. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. I'm honored that you would invite me. And I hope I'm talking above the front row. Good. Also, Bob, nice meeting you. I told Bob when I met him before the meeting, he's probably heard every AA lie there is. So I'm going to try to be really creative tonight. Maybe I'll have a few new ones add to that. Just a little bit about who I am. The very first time I took a drink, I knew I was an alcoholic. You know, I'm bodily, mentally different, just absolutely up front. I say I knew. I probably didn't know, but I was alcoholic from the very first drink. I was bigger, stronger, faster, better looking. You know, could do all that stuff that I was afraid to do. Very first drink. Didn't even take two. And, you know, I knew right away that this was the answer. That I found what I'd been looking for my whole life. And, my alcoholism kind of reminds me of the story about the alcoholic that's walking on the beach and he finds a bottle buried in the sand. And so he picks up the bottle and he clears all the sand off and he rubs the bottle and a genie comes out of the bottle. He says, you know, thank you for letting me out of this bottle. So I'll give you 3 wishes. You know, the alcoholic thinks about it for a minute and he goes, tell you what, this bottle of vodka, I want it filled up and I want it perpetually filled. Every time I drink it, it fills up again. Genie says, done. Alcoholic drinks the bottle, filled up again, drinks the bottle again. Genie gets tired of waiting around. Says, you know, come on, I need to get moving, you know. I need those other 2 wishes. And the alcoholic thinks about it in a minute and he goes, I want 2 more of these. Yeah. That's perfect. And, you know, and if you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, you understand that perfectly. You know, enough was never enough for me. One of the judgments, one of the things I'm going to do is I'll jump all over the place, so get used to it now. I'm going to go back and forth, and, I can't remember the story exactly how it is, so I have to go back and tell you things about it. But part of what I've been going through in the last couple of years, just to let you know a little bit about who I am, I'm going through a divorce and a separation, which is probably news to every alcoholic in here. And but I chose to do it in long-term sobriety and married to an alcoholic, so recovering alcoholic. And to even go one better, that's my 3rd. So my best friend has 5, and I'm doing my best not to catch up. But I say that because I don't want to get up here and paint any kind of picture. You know, other than who I am and the struggles that I go through. And I really believe strongly in sharing the solution and not spend a whole lot of time in the problem. I'm willing to bet that everybody that raised their hand as an alcoholic in this room understands to the depth of your soul what the problem is. And so I really want to talk more about the recovery. And for the newcomers, I do want to qualify myself real quickly, just so you know I am one of you. I mentioned that the very first time I took a drink, I knew that I was an alcoholic. And the way it just played out in my life was that once I started to drink, I couldn't stop. But I wasn't fortunate enough to black out. So I'm one of these kind of guys, when I did finally get sober, and I got sober on June 30th, 1986, which is 3 days after my daughter's birth. My youngest daughter was born on June 27th, 1986. So virtually, she has never seen me take a drink. She got sober when she was 14 years old, and she's now 21 years old. So it runs in my family. I like to say that I am the great-grandson of, the grandson of, the son of, the father of, the brother of, and multiple cousins of alcoholics. So I qualify for about every program that has an anonymous on the back end of it. But I come by this rightfully. You know, in my mind, it is a genetic disease, and I've been granted this by others, and I have passed it on to still others. And fortunately, my youngest daughter is sober, and I'm grateful for that. And I'm grateful for my sobriety. And what happened was, when I first got here, I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in December 3rd, 1979. So you can tell I was a real slow learner on how to get this thing. You know, and I came to a meeting, and I came by way of another ex-wife who had been married to three alcoholics before me, and chose me because she was sure I wasn't one. And so we got married, and she went to Al-Anon, and she used to drag me to the AA meetings. And I would go out in the parking lot after the meetings because I kind of liked what they said, but it didn't pertain to me. And I would stand out in the parking lot and share with these guys in the parking lot, and they'd tell me to keep coming back, and I'd keep coming back, and they would talk to me. And I told them one time on a stand, I said, you know, if I had the kind of problems you guys did, I'd do this thing. Yeah, and they laughed at me. And they told me, well, you know, maybe if you keep coming back, you might catch this thing. And I was sure I wouldn't. But what happened was, because it is a progressive disease, is it didn't get any better, it only got worse. And so that occasional drinking began to be an everyday drinking thing. And in fact, for me, alcohol was my best friend. Far and away, my best friend. It was the one thing that I knew really worked. It took away everything that I was afraid of. And it did it almost instantaneously. I could wake up in the morning. I was not a morning drinker. That's why I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. I wasn't a morning drinker because you can't be. You'd be an alcoholic if you drank in the morning. Unless it was on the weekends, and that doesn't count because, I mean, you're off. And, you know, as long as you drank after 5, unless it was a real special occasion, you know, and you drank before 5, I had all these rules, you know. If you wake up naked in the bushes, you're an alcoholic. Until you wake up naked in the bushes, and then you can't, you know, it's like, well, no, I'm not really an alcoholic. I mean, you got to have it happen more than once. So, and it did. So, So this thing progressed on me, and, you know, I'm one of these guys that I never got arrested, and I never got a DUI, and I'll tell you something, that kept me out there for a long time, because, you know, some guy would get up here in front of me, and he'd say, you know, I got arrested 112 times, I had 37 DUIs, I killed 11 people, I spent, you know, almost my entire life in Leavenworth. I'd go, wow, that's an alcoholic. So you know, what happened is I spent all my time identifying with somebody's story instead of identifying with how they felt. And when I stand here and I listen to how somebody feels, then I know they're an alcoholic because they feel like I do. They feel that black hole emptiness on the inside. And that's what I felt. I felt like, in the middle of me was this giant black hole that was just sucking me into it. And, you know, all the alcohol in the world just made it go. And it had big teeth on it, too. You know, it just kind of goes like that. And so I stick alcohol and drugs and women and cars and houses and moving and jobs and everything. And, you know, it goes like this. And it was fine for a while. And then it came back. And I needed to feed it again. You know, and I couldn't do the math from 79 to 86 on if I stopped drinking, maybe it'd go away. Maybe if I worked the steps. Maybe if I got a spiritual solution. Maybe that thing would go away and stay away. But see, I just didn't trust that anything but alcohol would help that. Because I knew that alcohol worked. What I didn't know was that God and the spiritual approach would work also. So, you know, just to qualify the kind of alcoholic I am, and how God, I don't know how I didn't get arrested. So I got this job as a manager of a car dealership. You know, and man, you talk about alcoholics in that business. Wow. And I was the boss of them. You know, so we drank every day. You know, we put it in the Coke cans and sold cars to people. So, you know, if you're a car salesman, bless you. Bless you that you can get here. Bless you. So, as part of this job, because I was the general manager of this store, I get a new car like every week. You know, they sell a car, get a new car. So I got a Dodge Charger, brand new Dodge Charger with the sunroof and all the stuff in it, you know. And so I'm going home and I'm on the freeway. And you know, I'd been drinking since 6. As soon as the owner left, we drank. So this is 9, 10 o'clock at night, so I've been drinking. And I don't go to a bar, so you can't be an alcoholic after work, you know. Didn't need to. So I'm going home and I got this brand new Dodge Charger and I go, you know, I'm on the freeway. I wonder how fast this thing can go. Right? How fast can a car like that go? I can tell you. Can go 120 miles an hour. Until you want to take your exit. It will not take a 25 mile an hour exit at over 100 miles an hour. Now, this car went airborne. Exit went that way. I went that way. You know, it's down a hill onto a four-lane street with a median in the middle of it. This car goes off. It hits once. It sideswipes a telephone pole that's sitting on this hill, lands one more time, lands in the oncoming traffic, lands on the median, and lands in the far lane of traffic. Not one car hit me. Not one car hit me. So I reached down and it hit so hard that the ignition key had flown out of the ignition. So it took me some time to find that. And lo and behold, the car started. So I just turned around and drove off with all the traffic stopped and looking at me. And I made a U-turn because I got to go the other way. So I drove back up over the median. Go over the median. I go down. The light turns red. And because I'm a law-abiding citizen, I stopped at the red light. And I look over the person next to me. And they're kind of looking at my car going. And it felt like it was riding a little funny. The smoke and the sparks gave it away. But so I drove home and I parked it in the driveway and I came in and I thought, you know, I got to come up with a good reason here. So I called the boss and I said, you know, I had a small accident. And he said, well, what happened? I said, somebody forced me off the freeway. And he said, would you have the car towed? And I said, no, it didn't need to be towed. He said, okay, well, we'll take care of it in the morning. So the next morning I get up, I walk outside, I walk around the other side of the car. There is no other side of the car. You know, the door is kind of dangling, the tires are flat, you know, the entire side missing, and it needed to be towed in, you know. So I had to explain to him how the car that didn't need to be towed in the night before actually did need to be towed in and was total. And being a good, it comes to the lies, you know, I did manage to lie about it. The point being, there's a friend of mine that talks about seconds and inches. That an alcoholic is alive by seconds and inches. And see, I'm an example of that. You know, if I would have made that decision 1 second later, I would have been 1 inch farther over when I sideswiped that telephone pole. And if that was true, you'd have a different speaker tonight. So by whatever the grace of God or whatever it is there that looks after me, I needed to be here and I need to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. So by seconds and inches, I didn't kill myself. And I tell that story because I, as an alcoholic, I could justify that behavior. Like, that's what normal people do on their way home from work. They take an exit at 100 miles an hour. And then they drive the car home because, you know, you don't want the police to show up and ask you a question. Plus the beer cans are in the back seat. So that's the kind of alcoholic I am. You know, I managed to get myself up to 250 pounds, which is about 60 pounds more than I am now. You know, I had high blood pressure. I couldn't walk around a block, much less run around a block. You know, I drank my way through marriages and children. And, you know, I tell this because later on in my recovery, I need to talk about what the other side of that looks like. But I was divorced before I got sober. I got remarried. Got divorced after I got sober. In fact, my ex-wife, one of the classic things that tell you you're married to the wrong person is when she looks at you after you got sober and said, you know, I really liked you a lot more when you drank. I said, gosh, you know, you mean the guy that drove home in blackouts and, you know, asked you to make sure that you told him what exit because I couldn't concentrate on keeping it on the road and get the exit at the same time? That guy you liked better? And she did. And so it either I got incredibly crummy sobriety or maybe I married an alcoholic, which was, I think, the case. I remarried in Alcoholics Anonymous. I married somebody that was that I knew her since the time she got sober, and I'll get into that too. And the thing about my sobriety is that even though, and I told you I came in 79, I kept coming back to the rooms. You know, even though I was absolutely sure that I wasn't an alcoholic, I liked what I heard. You know, and I used to sit there trying to figure out, if I was just maybe a little bit of an alcoholic, maybe I could do this and I could be happy and I could have friends. And I always admired that and the camaraderie and the laughter. You know, I believe a sense of humor is so important, incredibly important. And so what happened to me was a man that I met in Fresno. I knew his wife from Al-Anon and kind of met him in AA. I went back there one time to pick up my kids because I was living in Northern California. My kids were in Fresno. Through a psychologist, she told me, well, you know, I think you're the adult child of an alcoholic. That's your problem. Damn, I found it. Yeah, got it. See, because I was always looking at what's wrong. You know, all you had to do is put a label on me, and it was great. I'm an adult child alcoholic. Great. So I decided I'm going to tell Barbara that I'm an adult because I know she is too. So I tell her, and she goes, bullshit. Excuse me, are there kids in the room? If I drop an F-bomb, I apologize, and I'll throw another buck in the thing. So she goes, BS, and she said, "You're an alcoholic, you need to talk to John." And I'm like, okay. So her husband comes home from work, he sits at the kitchen table, and we talk for 2 hours, 2.5 hours. And he kept pounding on me, "You need to do something right now. Right now. You need to go into recovery right now." "I can't. I got a business meeting next week, and I got this going on, and I got this." And he goes, "No, we'll call Dean Duncan, who is the head of the Alcoholism Council in Fresno." And says, "We'll call Dean. You know, Dean will call your work. They can't fire you. You know, they'll be happy that you're in recovery. I'm going to tell you, Al, they know." "No, they don't." You know. "Yeah, they do." So, and they explained that to me also. So, I sit there for 2 hours and I'm not moving because I got great denial. And I'm not going anywhere. And I'm dying on the inside. And so as I get ready to leave, and he has hammered me and hammered me and hammered me, as I went to stand up, he said, "Let me ask you one more question." He said, "How old is your son?" I said, "I'm 10 years old." And he says, "So I guess what you're telling me is that you're going to continue to drink and drive your car until you kill either your 10-year-old son or somebody else's 10-year-old son." And that was the first moment that I knew I was an alcoholic. Because you know what my answer was? "You're right. I am going to do that." I absolutely knew in my innermost self that he was right. And I still left. Picked up my son, and I didn't drink on the way home just to prove to myself that I wasn't an alcoholic. And I went into a therapy session on that Monday, and the therapist who had run a recovery center, I explained this little story to her, and she says, "I tell you what," she says, "why don't you sit there until God gives you a moment of clarity about what you really are?" And she got up and walked out and left me sitting on the couch, and so I'm like, wow. What am I? So God gave me about that much of a moment of clarity. And that moment of clarity said, "You know, you are an alcoholic. And you need to get some help." So she came back in and I said, "Yeah, you know, maybe I need to do that thing." And so she picks up the phone and she calls the place where she had been the director. And they had one bed. And her next appointment had canceled. So she took me by the hand, and she took me over, and I discovered when I was put in this place, it had an architectural flaw. You know, no one explained that to me. There were no doorknobs on the inside. So I always called it a recovery house. But the truth was, I couldn't leave if I wanted to. So, you know, I guess it was imprisoned. But nevertheless, I did 30 days in there and came out and started going to meetings and got sponsors. And I went into the sponsor of the club, of the month club. Because I'm a very, very special guy. And you know, it takes a special person to sponsor me. So every month I had to switch sponsors because they weren't giving me the right stuff. You know, they want me to work the steps and go to meetings and, you know, not drink between meetings and, you know, things that I just, you know, fundamentally disagreed with. So, you know, after about 9 months, I found a physician that diagnosed my Valium deficiency. And it made sense. You know, that I was a very sensitive guy. I needed to take something, you know, and he gave me something to take. After I told him that I was a drug addict and an alcoholic and I can't take any of these things, he says, I understand that, but Valium helped. And it did. But it also sent me back out. So what happened was I reached a point of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And it happened around, I was out in my hot tub one night because I couldn't sleep, like, big surprise. And I'd been drinking vodka, and I was drinking vodka out of a water glass in the hot tub by myself. My wife was asleep because I told her I wasn't drinking anymore or taking drugs. So I had to do that alone. So I'm out in the hot tub with that, and I'm taking Valium and washing it down with vodka. And because he's lucky he's here, which is true. I mean, you know, a lot of people die that way. So finally I passed out, and I wake up the next morning, and my wife goes, you know, I'm so proud of you that you're not drinking or using it anymore. And, you know, if you would have spit, I would have slid underneath the door. You know, the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization of that moment was unbelievable. And I went to a meeting that morning, and I announced myself as an alcoholic and said that I was done, and everybody looked around, there he is one more time. And the difference was I knew I was done. And so a man in the front row that looked up and just shook his head, I thought, that's the guy I want to be my sponsor. And so after the meeting, I said, you know, Paul, I'd like you to be my sponsor. And I'm really serious this time. And he goes, no. I said, no. He goes, no. He said, I don't waste my time. And I said, waste your time on me? And he goes, Al, I've watched you for 7 or 8 years sitting around this room. He says, not taking this thing seriously. He says, you know, being a sponsor takes a lot of energy. And he says, I don't want to waste my time with you. So I convinced him to go to lunch, and the long story was is that I convinced him to sponsor me. And so we went to the big speaker meeting that night. And I'm sitting right behind his family. And, you know, and everybody, I stand up as a newcomer, and his, you know, family turns around and looks at me, and he turns around and he goes, all right, he says, I'll be your sponsor. I said, great. He says, now sit down and shut up. He says, people are getting real tired of listening to you. And it was the first direction I ever took. And so I began in a process of working the steps of being a part of this program. And I got to 6 months. I said I worked the steps. I don't know how many ever did this, but, you know, it was like I talked about working the steps. And I bragged about in meetings working the steps, but I didn't actually work them. I actually didn't even read them. But but nevertheless, I was good because I'm smart. So I could go to the meetings and talk about them and try to impress newcomers because I was sure somebody wanted me to sponsor them at 6 months. I was going in a business meeting, my first out-of-town business meeting, and everything in me wanted to drink. And my head told me that I can go to Seattle and I can drink in Seattle, and then I'll come back and I'll just lie to them. How are they going to know, right? I can come back and be brilliant again. You know, so I thought, that sounds like a good plan. And so just before I leave, I thought, you know, maybe I ought to run that by my sponsor. Just in case that isn't the good way to do this thing. So I said it to him, and he says, you know, I think you ought to do that. And I said, oh. And he goes, but just in case, before you do that, why don't you call Alcoholics Anonymous when you're up there and find out where a meeting is? Go to the meeting first, and if they haven't closed the bars down after the meeting, go have a drink. All right, that makes sense. So I go up there, and I stand at the Marriott Inn at the airport, and I call. When I first got there, I called, and I got all these addresses because I'm looking for a church in some white bread neighborhood, right? Because I'm special, and so I look at all these, got these addresses, they're all churches, you know, they seem like good neighborhoods and everything, and I get that. Then I go to the meeting, and the meeting gets out late, And it's like, I think it was like 9:30 when the meeting gets out. It's like a hot seat. No meetings. So I called back to Alcoholics Anonymous because I wanted, you know, be able to tell my sponsor that I tried. You know, but nobody was there to help me. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous and you know, said, I'm sure, you know, start off the way every good alcoholic does. I'm sure you don't have any meetings after 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. She goes, nonsense. We got 10 o'clock meetings. We got midnight meetings. We got all kinds. So that didn't work, so I decided to go to Plan B, which was Plan B was, I don't have a ride. You know, I'm going to need a ride to the meeting. And she goes, let me see what I can find. She gave me your number and all this. And so 5 minutes later, the phone rings. Hi, my name's Bill. He goes, you want to go to me? Well, yeah, so I'll be there. And where are you, at the airport? I said, okay. So I live pretty close, so I'll be there in about 10 minutes. He says, what do you look like? And I said, oh, 6'4". I got a blue blazer on. You know, I got all this stuff. And so he says, well, I'll have a leather jacket, and I've got a plaid shirt. Leather jacket, plaid shirt. And I'm about 55 years old. And I said, okay. So I'm sitting there, and this guy walks in the front. Now, I'm the only guy in the lobby. Guy walks in the front, and he has a greasy, tattered, torn leather jacket with a wrinkled-up, grease-stained, checkered shirt and holes in his pants and no teeth. And I'm like, God, please don't let this be Bill. So he walks back, and I'm the only 6'4" guy with a blue blazer and a shaved head, and I had a goatee then, you know, in the lobby. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm just going to tell him it's not me. He'll buy that, right? So he comes out and goes, hi, I'm Bill, I'm an alcoholic, you must be Al. And I said, yes. And he says, come on. He says, we got to hurry because the meeting starts in like 10 minutes. So, okay, so we start out, and it's raining. And his car is in the back of the parking lot. So it's raining, and didn't you bring an umbrella? So you don't need an umbrella. It rains all the time in Seattle. So we're walking in the rain, and we get back to his car, and he's got you know, one of those Ford station wagons with the wood on the side, you know. Woody, whatever it is. And you know, and the hood is wired shut. And the seat has springs sticking through it. And the door, you know, you have to hit it from the other side to open it. So I get in this car, and we start up down the freeway, and he starts drifting into the other lanes. And I'm like, God sent me a drunk. You know, I'm trying to do this right, and he sends me a drunk. We're drifting on the freeway. And the guy goes, you know, I'm really sorry. He says, I just had this brain operation. And I'm not supposed to drive at night. Now I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to die going to be sober. So we drive, and I got all these addresses for churches. He goes, I don't know where any of those are. He says, I got a place to go. So we drive right in the middle of Seattle, and we pull up in front of this place called the Easy Desert Inn Hall. Easy Desert Hall. And this is the place with the dirty windows and the naked light bulbs hanging down and a coffee pot that's had the same coffee in it for 2 years. It's got stuff floating in it, you know. And I'm like, holy Christ, I'm taking my rings off, you know. Put in my pocket. And I say, these guys are going to rob me. And so we go to this meeting, and it's an A meeting. I mean, the guys are just sharing, and he shares about this operation, and he talks about that he's been sober for 18 years. I'm like, wow, you know. And so they go around and share, and so they said, Al, would you like to share? No. No, I don't want to. Okay. And so I'm looking at my watch, and, you know, hey, what time does this meeting get over with? And he goes, well, it goes to 11:30. It started 10. It's an hour and a half meeting. And we're like 10:05. I said, oh, I got to get back, you know. I'm important, you know. I got to get my rest. So he said, okay, let's go. So he takes me out. We start driving back. And he starts sharing with me his story, which is what we do. He starts sharing his story with me. And see, this brain operation he had was a direct result of his alcoholism. And that what happened is that he had all these little microscopic bleeds in his brain, and that, you know, what he said was that he decided he needed to get it fixed because he's having memory problems. And they told him, you got to have this operation. And he said, so they opened up my head, and he says, Al, do you know how much God loves me? He said, when I was laying on that table with my head open, I had a massive stroke. And he says, the doctor said it would have killed me instantly if I hadn't have been laying on that table. Instantly. And so we talked and shared, and I shared with him, and I shared with him how I was feeling, that I wanted to take a drink, and everything in me wanted to take a drink. And he shared with me recovery. And we got back to the hotel, and he wrote his number down, and he says, you call me anytime. I'll take you a meeting anytime. You call me if you have a problem while you're here. You know, and I went up in the room, and I watered it up, and I threw it in the trash, and, you know, because he wasn't my kind of guy. And I woke up the next day, and my desire to drink was gone. Now, that was 21 years ago, and I have never had a desire to drink since. So see, for those that I said about the miracle, see, the miracle happened to me in spite of me. That this guy came out in a rainstorm when he wasn't supposed to drive at night to meet a guy that he didn't know, to take him to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting to be of service to somebody other than himself. He did what I've been asked to do in here, and he gave the miracle away to me. And I didn't even know it. And to me, that's the miracle of this program, is that giving it away. You know, I look at myself and I look at my alcoholism, and when I went through the steps the first time, what really jumped out to me, about, other than being powerless and being totally nuts, which I still am, and that the only thing that was really going to solve this for me was a God of my understanding, and was I willing to be willing? I didn't have to be willing. Were you be willing to be willing? That was the only thing I could ever be in the beginning. I'm willing to be willing. Okay, I can do that. Well, you know, eventually I became willing, and eventually I found a higher power. So, you know, it worked, and I choose to call that higher power God. But, and I don't know if this makes sense to anybody, but what I find about myself, about it, my innermost self, is that's the piece of me where God is. And it's kind of encapsulated, and it's encapsulated by this ego of mine. And that what I have to do is to learn to find ways to penetrate my ego so that I can find God. Now, the thing about it is, every one of those initiatory trips is a new trip. I've got to find a new way to do it every time. The old way doesn't work. See, so the way I worked the steps the first time won't work this time. The aha I got the first time won't work this time. You know, that's why I have to keep coming back, and I have to keep giving this message, is because each time I do that, some way it works through my ego. And what I'm learning today is that the ego part of me is good. I got to have an ego. This isn't about getting rid of my ego. It's about getting rid of the excesses of my ego. You know, I can't get out of this room without an ego. Something has to say, turn the doorknob to the right. You know? It's my problem is I keep stumbling over my ego. You know, my ego has invested me coming here. Oh, they want me to speak. Great. You know, hooray. So I'm playing golf in Las Vegas yesterday, right? And I'm sharing with these guys. Yeah, I'm coming down. There's a lot of people. They asked me to share. And I bend over and I hit my head. Right on the cart. Right, and I got this little hat on, and the little bump on the hat, you know, pound right into my head. So I got this big spot right here on the top of my head, and I go, okay. Maybe there was a little ego in that. You know? So I get here, and Liz listened to this whole thing on the way down. I get here, I change in the car, right? Because it's important. I didn't wear a tie. I can't do that. But, so I change in the car because I want to look good. You know, I give this message, right? So I got my coffee, right? And I take a drink of coffee, and it goes all down in front of me. So Liz goes, "You better turn on the heater." So the reason I was a little bit late getting in was I'm in the front seat of the car with the heater turned on, God has a way of showing me this thing about my ego. And what I realize is that I'm never going to get out of this thing without my ego. What I've had to learn is, what does my ego serve? You know, does my innermost self serve my ego, or does my ego serve my innermost self? When I'm working from the place of my ego working with my innermost self, I'm fine. When my ego starts running the show, because my ego is the thing that stays out there in the world. That's my ego. You know, when it's running the show, I'm in a lot of trouble. And what happens? I hit my head and I spill coffee down in front of me and I make an ass of myself. And, you know, I'm thank God Terry put this thing in front of here, because I'm the kind of guy that I hit this thing and over the front. And then I'll have to be really cool, you know, after you do something like that, you know. So this thing has been such a miracle for me. You know, such an incredible miracle. I was separated from my wife a year ago this last June, on my birthday, June 30th. She told me, "This isn't going to work. We need to separate." So we separated and I moved out and we worked some things out and we got back together and we were going to redo our vows. And 30 days later, I was the devil again. And, you know, we weren't going to do this. And on June 30th, this last year, she told me this is over. So two birthdays in a row, I got to share that, you know, my birthday. You know, guess what, Mr. 20 and 21 years? I got to share that stuff. But what happened as a result of that was I went back and worked the steps again. I asked a man that I really admired and I knew worked the steps, that actually has, I think he has a year more than I do, maybe 2 years. Right, and I said, I want to go through the steps, and I want to go through them like a newcomer. I don't want to go through them with a guy that sponsors guys and does. I want you to be hard on me. Well, on my fourth try on the first step, I had to explain, you got to back off this a little bit. You know, I'm not a newcomer. You know, so I did the steps the way he wanted me to do the steps. And I did them all. And I went through them. And the miracle of this thing was that, you know, I initially it was because I was going to get my wife back. You know, I'm going to show her and, you know, do all that. And got kind of found out that maybe we weren't meant to be together, but which is another story. But what happened as a result of this was I cleaned up my act. I looked at the wreckage of my present, the wreckage of my sobriety, the things that I've done in sobriety. I have not had a relationship with my oldest daughter, my oldest son, for many, many years. They have just not been able to get over my alcoholism. They have not been able to. I resented it at meetings when somebody said, you know, I've been sober 6.5 minutes, my entire family's back, you know, I got a better job than I ever had in my life, I got more money than I ever had, I'm sponsoring 11 people, life's great. And I thought, man, boy, I'm really done something wrong in here. And it continued through 20-some years. I went back, I worked the steps, I did what was asked of me to do. And about 6 months ago, it was the first week of June, my son called me out of nowhere. And he goes, hey, you know, Dad, I'm going to be in Southern California and I'd like to stop and see you. And we were able to put it back together. I have two grandchildren by him. And I was able to put that back together, and I have seen them every month since then, or more. At Christmas time, he and his wife were going to Costa Rica for a week, and he called me and said, "Would it be okay if I brought the kids down and they spent the time with you?" And that's with 21 years of sobriety. You know, and I freaked the first day. I mean, I called Liz like 23 times. Like, what do you do? Just be a little kid. Let them entertain you. What a cool thing. You know, I played computer games. We went to the... it was great. I had a great time. And as a good alcoholic, I trained him well. You know, I told him when your dad asked you how the time, tell him it's the best time you ever had. Best food you ever ate. Most fun you ever had. So he called me back last week. He said, boy, I don't know what you do to the girls. It was sad. He says, they keep telling us that that's the best time they ever had. Best food they ever ate. So my daughter, oldest daughter, calls me 2 months ago. And, you know, she says, Dad, you know, I'm getting too old to keep this up. And I want to have a relationship with you. And I'm getting married. And I want you to come to the wedding. I want you to be there. And I said, I'll be there. She says, you want to know when it is? And I said, no. I'll be there. Doesn't matter. You know, so the miracle for me is not that I got stuff back. No, that's not the miracle. The miracle is that the steps, the traditions of this program gave me a God in my life. And that when I follow the direction that God gives me, my life is incredible, no matter what happens. Thank you.